Well, it's good to be with you this evening. I wanted to thank Alan for his lesson this morning. I think it's really good from time to time to just take some time and think about the simple story of Jesus and what he did and what it means for us. And so I really appreciated that this morning. Tonight I want to build off of a couple other lessons that we've heard in the recent past. One last week when Mike Wilson was here, he taught a lesson on discipleship and prayer. And several weeks ago, Andrew presented a lesson on song worship. And it caused me to take some time and ask myself some questions about worship in general. You know, we talk a lot about the specific aspects of worship, but it's really important that we understand worship in general. And one of the questions that I asked was, why are we here? And I think that's a very general question, and I think it's a little too passive of a question. And I don't mean, why are we here on earth? What is the purpose of life? That kind of question. But why are we here right now? Why are we assembled here tonight? Why were we here this morning? Why are we going to come together next Wednesday night? And I think a better question is, what is our purpose here? What is our purpose when we gather together like this? What right do we have to exist here as a group of people and to worship? It's a very important question that we need to ask. And if we don't have a good reason for existing, then what is the purpose of existing at all? Why should we exist if there isn't a reason to? And there are essentially two options available to us. We can be the kind of person who thinks religion is about going to church. It's about going through a checklist of things that we need to get done. It's about sitting in a pew. It's about going through the motions, doing our thing, and then going home. And aside from a little sacrifice of time, maybe a little sacrifice of money, there's not much to it, and we don't expect to get a whole lot out of it. Or we might be one of the few who are coming here to catch just a glimpse of the majestic glory of eternity, the great power of God, the creator of this universe, and hopefully to gain some minute awareness of who God is. And someone who says, I want to know this God. I hunger and I thirst to know God. I am convicted that if I really know God, if I come to understand more about God, it will drastically impact me. It will drastically change me. Do we come here hoping for a lesson that's going to be entertaining, that will keep us awake? Or do we come here hoping that the experience will drastically shake us and make us more like God? That I need to be challenged because my understanding of who God is limited and therefore must change and must grow because God is God. Are we the people who are never satisfied with where we are at, but always must know more about our Creator? And the truth is that knowing God, knowing who He is, we are never going to grasp that fully in this life. Our current understanding of who God is never really going to be adequate or deserving of what God is deserving of. So what does this have to do with our worship? What do we expect out of worship? And I think this is a very crucial subject to discuss. And there are really two things that we cannot separate. The only way we can know God, the God that we worship, is as He has revealed Himself to us in His Word. But it's even more relevant to what we are doing here. Firstly, we know that the congregation here is a local group that is meant to support and to encourage one another. But really, as a group, we don't really do a whole lot of things. And let me clarify what I mean by that. Last year, we had our Bible forum, and many members were involved in passing out flyers, sending letters, really ministering to the community, hoping to bring people in so that they can have the same hope that we have. Now, was that a work of the Fayette Church of Christ? Well, in a sense, as we are members of the work here, maybe. But really, it was individuals who decided, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and I'm not a member of some bureaucracy that tells me what to do and when to do it. But those individuals who went out and did that, they made a decision that that was the best way that they could serve the Lord at that time and at that moment. And that should have been done without passing judgment on anyone else, because they too are individuals. They have to make decisions about what they are going to do at that particular time. And we need to be content to leave that judgment between them and God. After all, we are all going to stand before God in judgment and give an account for how we choose to live our lives and how we spend our time. So what is the role of the local church in all of this? It is to equip and to support and encourage the individuals in the work of serving God. Even in the preaching of the gospel, we don't have some official doctrine. We didn't all get together and vote on what we believe 1 Thessalonians 4 verse 4 means. It doesn't work that way. Now, we can support people financially. We support them in the teaching of the word, and we can have confidence that some people are going to do a good job with their work, and it may be that we don't have confidence in others. But there is no official teaching other than we follow the Bible and what God says. That alone is our standard. And again, it's a support group that supports individuals in the teachings of the Word. But when it comes to worship, that is something that we all come here and we do together. It is something that we are all involved in together. As a group, we come together to offer up our voices in praise to God and pour out our prayers to celebrate the resurrected life of Jesus in the Lord's Supper. And the way that we do that, the way that we participate in those different aspects of our worship, is going to be colored by our view of who God is. Is that what we want? And that's what I want us to think about tonight. What is our worship going to be like? Is our worship going to be like that first group? Well, this is good enough. Or are we here to know God? To understand more about Him? Are we here to meet God in our Bible study? Are we here to encounter God as we worship Him? And through worship, to know Him better, and through that, to be transformed and to change something about who we are. There are two basic points I'd like to make about worship that I think are indicated in Scripture. There is a sense in which we are transfixed in worship. And when we talk about people with a fixation, we're talking about people who are obsessed with something. They're mesmerized by something. And I think that's the way that worship is supposed to be. We are transfixed by God. We are obsessed with Him. We are mesmerized by Him. Our thoughts are continually on Him. We are transfixed on God. It's all about God. And that's the way worship is supposed to be. And there are churches unfortunately, everywhere across this country, around the world, that are worshiping man. Now, none of them are going to send a flyer out and say, come Sunday morning, we're going to worship man. Everybody claims to be worshiping God. But the question is, are we really worshiping God, or is the focus on us, on what I want, on my desires? It's like the Pharisee in Matthew chapter 18. You remember that story. He's standing there and he's praying. And he says, oh God, thank you. You know, you look at that. Wow, this is a really humble guy. He's thanking God. But look at the content of his prayer. Thank you, I'm not like this other guy. I'm not like him. It was all self-centered. It was all about him. He was worshiping himself under the pretense of worshiping God. And that's the worst kind of worship. At least if we're going to worship ourselves, let's be honest about it. Let's just go out and be on the lake or whatever and live whatever licentious life that we want to live. Let's be honest about it. It is a shameful person who is going to be worshiping himself and say that he's worshiping God. And is there a danger that we might do that ourselves in our own worship? Do we accept the truism of the Bible that worship is God-initiated, God-directed, and God-focused? Yes, man is involved, but only so far as his focus is completely on God. The focus is always on God. He is our gravitational pull around which we circle. He acts and speaks, and we listen and respond and listen to what God has to say. Think about the word worship in the English. What it means is to show the value or the worth of God. That's why the words worship and worth or worthy are so similar. They have the same root. And when you think about it that way, it's really gives you pause to think, are we truly, when we gather together, trying to show the value or the worth of God? This is one of the great truths about worship. How you worship displays perfectly what you think about God. It might not be showing what you think it shows, but God sees it for what it is. If we have a low opinion of God, it will affect the quality of our worship. So what is the value and worth of God that we are showing? Or to go back to the language of Scripture, we should be falling down before God as one bows to a king, to one with absolute power of life and death over us. That's the one with whom we have to deal with. So what do we think of such a God? Notice in Psalm chapter 96. Psalms chapter 96 and verse 1. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. Now, you go to some churches and you talk about fearing God, and they'll say, here's the door. We don't talk that way around here because that's not who God really is. He's not to be feared. God's your buddy. He's your friend. And yes, he's your friend. But the part that doesn't fit that is this fearing of God that the Bible talks about over and over and over again. 1 Chronicles chapter 16. 1 Chronicles 16 and verse 29. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. Bring an offering and come before Him. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Tremble before Him, all the earth. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. We see this principle time and time again in the Bible. A holy God requires us to approach Him in holiness. And a perfect example of that is a story that we're all very familiar with, the story of Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10 and beginning in verse 2. What did they do? They brought fire that the Lord had not said was to be used. And they brought it and they offered it. And what happened to them? They were consumed with fire. And what does Moses say to Aaron in Leviticus chapter 10. Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord has said, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified, and before all the people I will be glorified." And Aaron held his peace. We have to get it into our heads that worship is not determined by us. It is solely decided by what God says He is deserving of. I am holy and I will be treated as holy. I'm going to be honored before all the earth. Are we aware that this is the God that we appear before every single Sunday morning, every single Sunday night, every single Wednesday night, every single day of our lives? That's the God that we appear before. I have to be honest, that is frightening. Every time we gather together to sing the praises of God, what are we doing? We are approaching a holy God, one to be feared and one before whom we should tremble. If we truly understood who we are serving, that is the exact attitude we would have. Some say that this is just the Old Testament. God there is different than the God of the New Testament. And we do tend to draw those kind of distinctions. But the one major distinction made between the Old Testament and the New Testament is that God's covenant was not fully manifested. His will was not fully manifested in the Old as it is in the New. And since the problem of sin was not really dealt with till the coming of Jesus, there were a lot of things built into the system to remind the people that the problem of sin was still there. The priesthood stands before you and God. What does that tell you? There's still sin. The problem of sin is still there, and to a certain extent, the problem of sin is still here under the new covenant. But now that gap between us and God has been bridged through Jesus. But the one thing that does not change, and I can say this with absolute certainty, is the character of God. He was holy and feared then, and He should be holy and feared now. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, and the last couple of verses there. Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. We need to be grateful. But we have to be careful how we manifest that thanksgiving to God. It must be done in reverence and awe if it is to be done right. Have you ever heard somebody who who just flippantly says thank you, and you know they don't really mean it. Think about what we have been given. What we have been given, we cannot begin to comprehend the magnitude of this gift. It's not enough just to get together flippantly and say, well, thanks God. Because notice the last line of chapter 12. For our God is a consuming fire. The same God of Nadab and Abihu. You approach God like Nadab and Abihu did, where you think that it's up to you to decide how you worship God or come before Him, with less than reverential attitude, and you can expect that same consuming fire. And I don't mean literally, but that's the kind of reverential attitude we must have to show how we value God and show the world how much we honor Him, that He is honored before all people. And that really brings the question, when people come here, when they visit the Fayette Church of Christ, do they go away saying, those people fear God, they respect God, they glorify God? If there's one thing those people stand for, it's God. And they honor Him in all of their actions. Is that the impression that we leave people with? If it isn't, then I would suggest there's something wrong with the way that we are worshiping, something ineffective about what we are doing. Hebrews chapter 13, verses 15 and 16. Through Him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge His name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. So not only are we to have this reverential attitude, but we also manifest that in our sacrifice, in our sacrificial attitude towards God. And these are not animal sacrifices like we see in the Old Testament. Again, that's one of those things where we see a greater fulfillment in the New Testament. But God was trying to teach them something, that the sacrifices had to be perfect. You can't just offer to God something that is secondhand or second best or faulty. Remember David at the threshing floor of Arunah. Remember his story. He had committed a sin, and he goes there to offer a sacrifice to the Lord, and the man there offers to give him everything for the sacrifice. And what does David say? I cannot offer to God that which has cost me nothing. And I think that begs the question, and I think we all need to ask this of ourselves right now. What did you sacrifice today to worship God? If we have this idea that we can just open up our Bibles and read the text and that there's no sacrifice there, then we're missing something. If we can sing and there is no sacrifice, then we're missing something. Because we are dealing with God, the infinite creator of all that there is, and the very one who sacrificed Himself for us, for our sin and rebellion against Him, and for us to think about Him and His grace, that must cause us an immeasurable degree of pain as we reflect on what we have done, and in so many cases what we continue to do to Him. And yet the glory that is due Him, and how we fall so far short of the praise of which He is deserving, how inadequate that must make us feel. You know, we don't come here to make ourselves feel good or to pat ourselves on the back. We come here to know God. But every time you come to know God, here's the sacrifice. You take the risk that you're going to find out more about yourself. And that is not a pretty picture. But it should give us a greater sense of our own unworthiness and the greatness of the God that we serve even more. So we're called upon to make a sacrifice, and it isn't just in worship like in an assembly like this, singing and praying and so on. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1 talks about our whole lives becoming sacrifices. Is there a sacrifice in refusing to conform to the world? Absolutely. Is there a sacrifice in being transformed? Yes. Is there a sacrifice in offering up service to God in a way that is living and holy? Absolutely. And so we are so focused on glorifying God and reverencing Him that we give Him all. We sacrifice all, and in so doing, we fulfill the great commandment, love the Lord your God with your whole being. If you love your spouse with all your being, does that involve sacrifice? If you love your children with everything that is in you, does that involve sacrifice? Yes. And so, how much more, if you love God with your whole being, does that call us to sacrifice everything for Him? How often does the psalmist talk about taking delight in God, just the sheer bliss of knowing God, even though it's hard, and a sacrifice? It makes us feel so inadequate. Again, in your relationship with your children, if your attitude is, well, I'm a wonderful parent, then your relationship with your children probably isn't all that it should be. If you think, I'm the greatest husband in the world, well, your relationship probably isn't what it should be. And if you think that you're doing God a favor by being His servant and worshiping in Him, and He's just lucky to have you, then your relationship with Him is not what it ought to be. We are called to find delight, but not in ourselves, in God. Psalm 103 in verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless His holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all His benefits, who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. Do you see the delight, the sheer pleasure that the psalmist has in God there? Just the sense of sheer pleasure and delight, not found in some self-indulgent action as the world indoctrinates us, but truly finding pleasure in God. As we saw in Romans 12, he speaks of transformation, and that is also part of what worship is. Change is a dirty word to a lot of people. But God, or the Word of God, is not what we are changing. We are changing ourselves. We are to be transformed ourselves. Acknowledge that when we talk about being transfixed in worship, when we seek to understand the majesty and the infinity of God, when it comes to our relationship with God, we are being transformed and changed through the worship that we do. And that's why we need to be careful how we spend our time and what we devote ourselves to, because it is very true, what we devote ourselves to is what we become like. It becomes our standard that we conform ourselves to. Again, that's why our religion is only going to be as good as the God that we serve. What is our standard? It's our fixation. It's God. And when God is our standard, when He is our fixation, it can't help but change us. It can't help but transform who we are. Isaiah chapter 6. I want to wrap up with this scene here in Isaiah chapter 6. Because I think it is a great analogy of what our worship is supposed to be like. In verse 1 it says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple." At the end of the book of Isaiah, we get this picture of Jesus saying, "How can you build me something that can contain me?" And as we see here in verse 1, just the hem of God's robe fills the temple. And then going on in verse 2, "Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And he called to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, 'Woe is me, for I am lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.' Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.' And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' Then I said, 'Here I am. Send me.' And he said, 'Go and say to the people, keep on hearing, but do not understand. Keep on seeing, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people dull and their ears heavy, and blind their eyes. Let their eyes see, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed.'" You know, it's sad that all this happens and God tells him, "No one's going to listen to you, but go tell them anyway." Who wants to preach a message like that? Why bother? Because God preaches His Word, and all people have the chance to hear it and choose for themselves what they're going to do with it. This is, and I think this section here is a perfect analogy of what worship is supposed to be like. The first thing we see is Isaiah sees Jesus. He sees God and is convicted of one great truth that covers everything else. God is holy. That's where it begins with him. That's where it must begin with us. We must see God and His attributes revealed to us in Scripture: holy, merciful, just, and grace. And what do we do when we see Him truly like that? What does Isaiah do? He confesses his sin. Luke 5, remember, when Peter realizes who Jesus is, he says, "I am a sinner. Leave me." That's why the only people who can come and find comfort in God are those who are sick and know that they are sick. We must humble ourselves before God because He is holy and you are not. And if that is not an awareness that we come to when we are worshiping God together, then we don't see our sin for what it really is. We will not be thankful because we don't think that there's anything to be thankful for. We need to know God, and then we'll see ourselves all too clearly. But that's not the end of the story here. What happens next is we see God as a forgiving God. He removes Isaiah's sin and does so for us in our worship, as long as we are wholly focused on Him and understand our own unworthiness. And that doesn't minimize our sin, rather it maximizes God. And the final element is Isaiah's own commission to go preach. If we come together and truly worship like we ought to, the result is a greater determination to go out into the world and be who we ought to be and teach that same thing. If it has not done that, then our worship has been a failure in some way. In our worship, we must know God better. We must know our sin, and we must confess it and seek His forgiveness, and then determine to go out and do the Lord's work. That's what worship is. And unless we achieve that, we have not fulfilled the purpose of coming together to worship. We are not here for ourselves, we are here for God. And that means we must make ourselves better equipped to conform ourselves with the will of God. So what kind of worship are we going to offer here? Is it a worship where people will see and encounter and know God? Are we going to insist that people's lives be transformed by worshiping God? Now, I want to put all this in terms that are a little easier to understand. I think it highly unlikely that our worship is going to be perversed by our altering certain forms of worship. For example, we have the Lord's Supper. It's made up of the unleavened bread, the fruit of the vine. And I don't see a great probability of, in the near future, us switching that out for hamburgers and Coke. I think it's going to stay the unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine. I don't think that we have to worry about perverting our worship in that way. But I'm afraid that because we're not worried about that, that we begin to think that because the aspects of our worship are in accordance with what God says, that our worship is then correct. The danger is that we may have everything right in what we're supposed to do, but our attitude is not what it's supposed to be. How shameful it is if we worship with the idea that I just need to get my hour in here. And I hope it's entertaining and I hope it makes me feel good because everything must be okay about the service because everything is the way that it's supposed to be. What does it mean to say that I like the tune of that song if we're not thinking about the words of the song that we're singing? If all we say is that I like the tune of that song, well, I like hamburgers. What's the big deal? What's the difference? The question is, does it help us focus on God? Help us know who God is? You have to think that a sermon that speaks to the issues and the problems facing a congregation is a better lesson than one that is, well, you all be good this week. Go out there and do a good job. That's important. But is it a foregone conclusion that anything we do that focuses our minds on God is going to be better for us than things that don't? Do we as a group of God's people, are we going to be content? Are we going to aspire for something better? Whether it be in our prayers, whether it be in our singing, whether it be in the Lord's Supper or in the speaking, whatever it may be. We are not truly worshiping God if we do not aspire to know Him and to be like Him. That is not true worship if we are content just where we're at. So I want to exhort you strongly that if you're going to lead in some way, say it be a prayer. Think to yourselves, here is an opportunity I have to lead people in growing with God. Now, what am I going to say that is going to be helpful to focus us on God and knowing Him better? And I think that goes for every aspect of our worship. How can my leadership bring people to a greater knowledge of God and a greater focus on Him? And that's not just for the leaders. It's for those sitting in the audience and participating. If we would remember what worship is, what it's for, and more than that, who it is that we're worshiping, then it could not help but make our worship better. Worship, yes, is about what we do, but more than that, it's about our attitude and our heart, being wholly focused on God, seeking to know Him. Thank you for your attention this evening. If you're not a Christian, this is an opportunity for you to make your life right with God, to come to Him. He longs to have that relationship with you. And it's not easy, and it requires a devotion and a commitment on your part, part of which is to worship Him in the right way, in a way that He is deserving of. And if you are a Christian and you haven't been living your life the way that you should, again, Jesus longs to have you come to Him. He longs to have that relationship with you. If there's anything that we can do for you this evening, we ask that you come forward and stand and sing.